Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets from the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on Soundbites, we talk about the poor working conditions behind the food that we eat in restaurants. We talk with Shirley Sherrod about her work to save the life of small farmers throughout the South and the connection between calories, sugar, and the Mediterranean diet. We start with Saru Jayaraman, an activist, author, and professor who joined us in our studios in Baltimore to talk about her new book, Behind the Kitchen Door. In it, she exposes the poor working conditions and discriminatory labor practices, as well as the unsanitary kitchens in a lot of the restaurants in our country. She asks how restaurant workers survive on some of the lowest wages in America, and how the industry's practices ultimately impact the food that arrives at our restaurant tables. Saru, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So this is interesting. The fastest growing part of America being our food industry. Talk about the contradiction here for a minute. Open it up with a contradiction.
Yeah.
Fastest growing part of the of our economy, the lowest paying.
That's right.
In terms of wages of our economy.
That's right. So there are over 20 million workers in our food system in the United States.
20 million.
Actually, one in five American workers in the private sector works in food.
That's everything from farming to restaurants, right?
That's right. All the way up the chain. Farm workers, meat and poultry processing, food retail and distribution. More than half of that 20 million or more than 10 million workers work in the restaurant industry. And it is neck and neck with retail as the largest and fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It also happens to be the employer of 7 of the 10 lowest paying jobs in America, and also the employer of the 2 absolute lowest paying jobs in America.
What
are
would
restaurant
those be?
Jobs. Dishwashers and fast food preps and cooks are the poorest workers in America. Now, servers and all the other positions in the industry are very close, third and fourth.
Right.
But they're, on the whole, the poorest workers in America. And it's largely due to the power of this incredibly powerful corporate lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which we call
the NRA.
That's right, the other NRA. That's right. And back in 1996, Herman Cain, recent Republican nominee, when he was the head of the NRA, the National Restaurant Association, struck a deal with Congress saying that they would not oppose the overall minimum wage continuing to rise as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stayed frozen forever at $2.13 an hour. And that's what it's been for the last 22 years.
And we're talking about an industry that I was reading, the $660 billion industry in terms of their sales in 2013.
Right. That's right. And CEO salaries are out the roof. You know, we have a campaign against Darden, which is the world's largest full-service restaurant company that you've never heard of. It owns Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse, and about 8 other brands. And it has been lobbying unrelentlessly for the last several years to keep the minimum wage at $2.13, to prevent paid sick days from getting passed anywhere. And this company CEO makes $8.5 million a year and $22.5 million in stocks and shares, you know, in the company.
Right.
So he's doing great. There's a 532 times difference between a ratio between his salary and the worker's salary wages. And so you've got an industry that's actually doing quite well, you know, across the board. They have a 4-5% profit margin. Now, compare that with Walmart, which is a horrible employer, but everybody thinks of Walmart as a very profitable company. They have a 1% profit margin. So this industry cries, you know, we have very tiny profit margins, and yet they're doing quite well. It's just that they refuse to pay their own workers. They expect customers to pay their workers for them, because with a wage as low as $2.13 an hour, the argument is
they're tipped workers.
That's right. Tips will make up the difference between $2.13 and the regular minimum wage.
But they don't. I mean, some of the stories you have in here. There's one story in here when you come to tips. You have this fellow named. You have one of the great things about this book. It's not just a kind of laborious statistical story of the food industry or a polemic. Thank God. Thank you. but it's full of people's stories, human beings, what they live through, people we know.
That's right.
People we should know.
That's right.
Let's take a few of them as we go through. Mike.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Talking about his looking at this check he gets.
That's right. That's right. Happens all the time. So this was a story that actually really surprised me because, you know, I'm a woman of color. I know lots of immigrants and people of color in this industry who struggle. I never thought that a white man fine dining server could struggle as much as Mike did. So Mike worked at a fine, fancy dining restaurant at in Detroit. And earned $2.77, which is the tip minimum wage in Michigan. Thought that he'd do great with the tips because that's what you assume.
Right.
And took home about $200 a week. And the wages went entirely to taxes because when you earn as little as $2.77, the wage goes entirely to tax. And so you get a paycheck that says, this is not a paycheck, literally. And you live on your tips. And when times are slow,
it
says it's not a paycheck. And, you know, you when times are slow, when it's late at night, graveyard shift or whatever, and customers don't come in, you have a slow night, you get nothing. You literally get nothing. And the restaurant in that case, very fine dining restaurant, is supposed to make up the difference, ensure that the tips make up the difference between the tip minimum wage and the regular minimum wage. His restaurant didn't. In fact, when he complained about it, they fired him. And, you know, this is so common. There's another story of Claudia, a worker who worked at the IHOP, which is a mega corporation. And they did the same thing. They did not make sure that the tips made up the difference between $2.13 and the regular minimum wage. And they actually said to her, we're not going to compensate you, but you have to report that you're making $7.25 because we don't want to be held liable for making up the difference. So she was taxed at $7.25 and paid $2.13 an hour. And you know, these are workers who, you know, college educated, you know, they're doing it because they love service. They love hospitality. It's not because they have no other options. And the industry treats them as disposable.
What's interesting to me over the years of interviewing people who work in this industry, especially workers who are trying to organize in hotels who work as servers, what you just said is important and it's true. They love it. They love serving people.
That's right.
They love the interaction with the public.
That's right.
At the beginning of your book says that one worker's quote, they love being part of people's lives.
That's
and
right.
Serving stuff.
That's
and
right.
It's real.
It's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, hospitality is in their blood. They love the feeling of making people happy. And yet they're not treated like professionals. They're treated disposably. It's interesting. When I'm on radio shows like this and there's somebody from the Restaurant Association on the other side, their argument is always, well, you know, these are students and actors. They're moving on to something bigger and better. And so it's okay that they're paid as little as $2.13. Tips make up the difference. Well, first of all, why are you putting down your own industry? This is a great industry. Your workers take great pride in it. Treat them like professionals that they are. Allow them the ability to have some stability and security with a wage that allows them to take home, you know, at least put food on their table. Servers like Mike and Claudia suffer from poverty rate of 3 times the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce. And so it's not fair to them, and then it's not fair to us as customers. Why should the industry expect us to pay their workers' wages for them and then suffer when workers are homeless or sick because they can't afford to take a day off when sick? That impacts us as customers.
And they're also, most of them are not students and actors.
No, that's very true. The majority of them are working adults with kids.
Right.
You know, these people take great pride in it. They make a career out of it. It's the problem, the reason for the transiency in the industry turnover is because workers have to move from restaurant to restaurant looking for better jobs to support their families. It's not that they're leaving the industry to go on to something quote-unquote better. It's that on the whole, people are constantly looking for a better way to support themselves and their families. And we need to ensure that the people who are putting food on our tables can put food on their own tables as well.
So, and it I mean, I think that people don't know this world.
That's right.
I mean, have no understanding what you're walking into when you just mentioned that Darden Corporation.
That's right.
That you write about them. All middle class folks, and a lot of middle class folks, working people go to these restaurants.
That's right.
Because they can afford to go to these restaurants, and that's where they go for their fine dining.
That's right, yes. Sadly, yes. I mean, sadly in the sense that we go to these restaurants thinking that, you know, we're having a great time, and these people, you know, you would think going to an Olive Garden or Red Lobster, where you actually do pay quite a bit. You know, it's a sizable meal, sizable check. That the workers would at least have paid sick days to make sure you don't get sick and that they're paid a decent wage. But let me tell you a story about the Olive Garden. The Olive Garden recently announced a partnership with Michelle Obama around her Let's Move campaign, saying that they would provide healthy food for kids in the Olive Garden. The same time that they made that announcement, fall 2011, a server in a Fayetteville, North Carolina Olive Garden came down with hepatitis A, had to work with Hep A, and 3,000 people in Fayetteville had to get tested for hepatitis A, filed a consumer class action against the restaurant, and won. Same time period, another server in an Olive Garden in Illinois came down with a norovirus. Hundreds of people got sick. I mean, how healthy can it really be for your kids if the workers are being forced to work with hepatitis A or norovirus? And the thing that people should know is this is a corporation that's not just following the law in not providing paid sick days or paying 213. They're making the law. That's what people need to know. These people are part of the mega trade association, the National Restaurant Association, and together are pouring literally millions of dollars into Congress members' hands to say, no, no paid sick days, keep the minimum wage at 213. And we don't know purposefully. We don't, you know, the industry would love the fact that we don't know that it's 213, would love the fact that we think that our tips are on top of a wage as opposed to the wage itself.
Right. It is the wage.
That's right.
I mean, you talk about people being sick. There's stories of people in this book, like Nikki and Wong.
That's right.
That you have that are unbelievable. I mean, share some of that with them.
Yeah.
They're really...
And this is actually here in the Baltimore, D.C.
right.
area.
That's why I picked them out.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, Nikki and Wong both worked here in the D.C. area, D.C. Baltimore area. Nikki worked for years as a server and never had a paid sick day, often didn't get paid at all, just worked on her tips. And on several instances was sick. And one time she was working at a restaurant that proclaimed that it was sourcing locally, providing organic food, and yet was doing really gross things and never provided a paid sick day. And so here was a restaurant that forced her to work with pink eye, with conjunctivitis. She had to come in and her eye was all pussy and red and tearing up. And she was serving drinks. She was a bartender, serving drinks to people with this stuff coming out of her eye. And the customers were disgusted. And she said, I could be home. I don't have money to take care of myself. I don't have time to take care of myself because I can't take a day off when I'm sick. And yet here's a restaurant proclaiming that it's providing healthy, organic, locally sourced food. Oong, even more extreme, Korean immigrant worker, worked in fancy fine dining restaurants as a server in Washington, D.C., 277. And he actually, it's interesting, Oong moved from California, where there is no difference between tipped workers' wages and non-tipped workers' wages. Everybody earns $8 across the board. And that's a state that's doing great, by the way. So to the argument that raising the wage would kill jobs, it just doesn't hold true when you look at California. So Oong moved from California. His wage went down from $8 down to $2.77 when he moved to the nation's capital. Serving people in these fine dining restaurants, starts to feel really sick. Of course, he doesn't have paid sick days. And when you earn as little as $2.77, you have to go in because you might lose your job and because, you know, you live on your tips. So he goes in, he feels sick day after day. Finally, he just can't even get out of bed and finds out that he has H1N1. And so Oong says, how many days did I expose people to this, to H1N1 and not know it, serve people food and not know it? And I couldn't even take a day off to find out, you know. Actually, after writing the book, I heard the most heartbreaking story I've ever heard, which is a woman who worked at the Olive Garden for 20 years as a bartender and could never had a paid sick day, but often felt a lot of pain in her arm and her leg, and because she was serving foods, you know, on your feet all the time, right, carrying trays. got to the point where she completely lost all feeling in her arm and her leg, had to go see a doctor at that point. Like, she could no longer lift her arm. Went to the doctor and found out that she had developed a very severe carpal tunnel and sciatic nerve condition, that she would have to be on really, you know, horrible medication, all kinds of things. Filed for workers' compensation, and the restaurant fired her 3 weeks later. And no disability. Won't even give her disability. Here she is now, 53, without a job, without disability, without workers' comp, unable to go find another job because she can't stand up. She's in extreme pain. I mean, the callousness of these corporations is just beyond belief. And when I say callousness, it's callousness not just because they don't take care of their people, but because instead of taking care of their people, they're in D.C. on Capitol Hill paying millions of dollars to lawmakers to say, no, we should not have to provide paid sick days, and no, we should not have to pay more than $2.13 an hour.
Which is why she made, I mean, there's so many people that we've been talking to recently here who are homeless.
That's right.
And this is one of the reasons people are homeless.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. You know, these are, what I'm talking about are working people,
right,
willing to work, able to work, working, and who are driven to all kinds of extremes. Nikki, for example, young woman, college educated, graduated from her college class, you know, with honors. University of Maryland, actually.
Right.
Chapel Hill. And she couldn't, she couldn't pay the,
right.
I'm sorry, College Park. Yeah. Right. And she couldn't pay the rent. She couldn't pay the rent because the tips weren't enough. She was earning $277. She would get these, this is not a paycheck, paychecks. And she's, you know, she says now, you know, she's told us in tears, you know, I never thought I'd get to this situation. Here I am, a college educated person. I prided myself on how smart and capable I am. I did this because I love hospitality. I thought it was a career I could move up in. And yet here I am finding myself on somebody's couch, evicted or unable to pay the rent. You know, it's like President Obama said in his State of the Union, you know, nobody in America should have to feel that they are working full time and still living in extreme poverty, relying on food stamps, unable to pay the rent, unable to support their families. Nobody should be in that situation.
And of course, this, I mean, the retail and food being the fast growing industries where people are making the least amount of money.
Yes, that's right.
So the jobs are growing, but these are the kind of jobs
that are
growing.
These are the jobs. I just heard a statistic yesterday from a Columbia professor that right now 1 in 4 American jobs are low-wage jobs. And by 2020, 1 in 2 American jobs will be low-wage jobs. And the growth there is entirely restaurants and retail. These are the jobs that are growing. So for people who, you know, are getting laid off from other sectors or just looking for work coming out of school, these are the jobs. And this is how we're introducing Americans to the workforce.
And the other half of America is going into debt on their credit cards.
That's right.
To support these industries.
That's right.
So one of the things I think is some of the things in here to make sure we get out is the issue of race.
Mm-hmm.
Front of the house, back of the house.
That's right, yes.
We don't think about this part of it at all.
We don't. It's often invisible to us. But we have found a $4 wage gap between white workers and workers of color. And it's entirely due to what we call occupational segregation. White workers holding the only livable wage jobs in this industry, which are fine dining, waitstaff, and bartending positions. Now, don't get me wrong. Waitstaff and bartending positions, on the whole, are not well-paying jobs because most waiters and bartenders work in Denny's and IHOP and Olive Garden. But there is this tiny percentage of the industry that works in the fine dining steakhouse as a waiter or a bartender. Those jobs are held almost entirely by white workers. Bussers, runners, all the way back into the kitchen. It's like almost as if the farther back you go, the darker the skin color. And in fact, we conducted a study back in 2009. Yes.
That's amazing. This is an amazing story. Yeah.
Where we sent 200 pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants to see who would get hired. We found gave the people of color a slightly better resume, and we found that the white workers still had twice the chance of the person of color of getting one of these jobs. And then we
reminds me of the old housing study when the people went to get
exactly
rent,
the same thing. Exactly. And listen to this language: front of the house and
back
of the house.
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
The farther you go into the back, the darker the skin color. And, you know, here's the thing. A lot of people, the industry says, oh, it's because they can't speak English well or because they're quote unquote illegal, which is a term we would never use. But they, that's what they say. So we took them on their word. We said, OK, we'll give the white testers an accent and the people of color an accent and see who gets hired. Well, the white testers, an accent was a bonus. It got them a better job.
Right.
The people of color having
an accent
was a
good
job.
Accent.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. The cute right. Irish accent or the cute French accent right. as opposed to who wants a, you know, according to the industry, who wants a waiter with a Spanish accent?
Or a Jamaican accent.
That's right. When, in fact, even the customer population is diversifying, right? Everybody eats out. And so I think the restaurant industry would do well for itself if it promoted from within. We have found employers that we work with across the board who, small business, great employers, who do the right thing, provide good wages and good working conditions and opportunities for people to advance. They have a more loyal workforce. They have less turnover, far less turnover. They don't have to rehire and retrain people, so less costs. In the long run, they have better productivity from their workers, better profitability, better service. So we have partners, like 100 employer partners that range from small mom-and-pop restaurants all the way up to star celebrity chefs like Tom Colicchio, great employer, who owns Kraft Restaurants. These people want to do right by their workers, and they find that they profit because of that, not in spite of that.
And you can see it when you go to places to eat or walk past a restaurant that the wait staff is white.
That's right. Yeah.
In the upper scale restaurants, there are a few who are really doing something different. Here in Baltimore, there are places like the Dogwood and Donna's Restaurants and others in Baltimore that hire an interracial wait staff.
Mm,
you know,
that's great.
And you can see there's people who actually are doing it, trying to treat people
right.
in a different way.
Right.
But they're far and few between.
That's right. Yeah.
You put out this book, this pamphlet.
That's right.
Right?
We put out the Rock National Diner's Guide and a smartphone app actually to go with it.
Oh, this is a smartphone. I got to download that app.
Yes. Right? It's free. You just go on your smartphone and you put in the ROC, National Diner's Guide, and it tells you how the restaurants around you are faring on issues of minimum wage, paid sick days, and race. All of these things we've talked about, promotions from within. And actually, we've also given awards to 70 of our high road employer partners who are doing the right thing, providing good wages and good working conditions. They get gold and silver awards.
Is it national in every city in America?
It's national. It's national. But most of the restaurants in there, we primarily focused on the 150 most popular restaurants in America, which are the Olive Gardens and Red Lobsters and Roots Chris and Morton's Steakhouse, to tell you how those restaurants are doing.
How do they do?
Universally pretty badly. And the reason why we put out this guide is actually not to tell people where to eat and where not to eat. It's to give you a tool wherever you eat, because we want you to keep eating out wherever you – if you love the Red Lobster, keep eating there. We just are encouraging you to speak up at the end of every meal. So we believe at the end of your meal, if you were to say, I love the food, I love the service, but, you know, I'd really love to see your company provide paid sick days, or I'd love to see your company pay more than $3.63 here in Maryland. We think that would make a tremendous difference.
Why is it so hard for workers in this industry to organize, to make a stand?
Yeah.
I mean, and you've written about you've written about some of the things that have happened in California where workers actually organized in San Francisco and other places
yeah.
to stand up. But why, you can talk a bit about that, but why is it so difficult for this industry to organize in unions and other places to stand up and make their own case?
I don't think it's so difficult. I just think there's 10 million. So what has happened is that the industry has exploded in growth, and the employer lobby has become so incredibly powerful, just as the labor movement in the United States has shrunk.
Right.
And the two things have happened at exactly the same time. And so you've got this incredibly large industry. So we're growing really fast, which shows it's not hard to organize these workers. It's just hard to reach the numbers you need to reach to have the power to counterbalance the National Restaurant Association. But we're getting there. And I will say there's a lot of momentum right now. It's the most exciting moment we've ever had. President Obama mentioned the minimum wage in his State of the Union. There is a minimum wage fight right here in Maryland that's really exciting. I was in the state legislature yesterday with a lot of great people from here in Maryland. No, I didn't.
He's the young African-American union worker who actually started this.
That's great.
It was he who kind of stood up and said, we have to end this.
That's great.
And he organized an entire coalition of people to fight for this
raising
the minimum wage.
Well, what's fantastic is that Maryland has the opportunity to lead the nation in that included in this bill is a raise for tipped workers. A raise right now, Maryland's minimum wage is $3.63, or 50% of the regular minimum wage. The bill includes not only the minimum wage going up from 7 to 10, which is much more decent, still not what people need, but much more decent, but also a raise for tipped workers from 50% of the regular to 70% of the regular, which would bring them up to at least $7. And there are three things we think people can do to actually be part of changing this industry and have a voice in Maryland and also at the federal level. One is to please buy the book and help build a buzz around the book. Because
behind the kitchen door.
That's right. The book is actually not just a book. It's a call to action. And our idea is that if we can get it to be a national bestseller, just like Fast Food Nation or Omnivore's Dilemma, that millions more people will read it and know what's going on. And education really is power. The second thing is that we've created a new organization for everybody who eats out called the Welcome Table. It's our way to collectivize our voices to tell Congress that as people who eat and eat out, we really need change in the food system. So it's thewelcometable.net. It's easy to join. And the third thing is to please speak up every time you eat out. Tipping better is just not enough. You know, we can all tip well. That's great. But I really hope people don't leave this conversation or read the book and think the best that we can do is just tip better. Because if we just continue to tip better, it will leave the industry off the hook. Let them continue to pay as little as they do because we're paying their workers' wages for them. So instead, at the end of every meal, we're asking that you just say, love the food, love the service, would love to see you raise your wages, provide paid sick days, promote from within. You've got great workers of color who could move up to wait staff. Please do so. I want to see that as a customer. That's important to me.
That was Saru J. Ayerman, activist, professor, and author of Behind the Kitchen Door. She's co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. We're going to talk with Shirley Sherrod, hear her story, and get her perspective on agriculture in America and learn about the Mediterranean diet. So stay with us. Welcome back to Soundbites, a show that explores the future of our food system. I interviewed Shirley Sherrod at the Enoch Pratt Library on February 17th about her book, The Courage to Hope, How I Stood Up to the Politics of Fear. Shirley Sherrod is a former U.S. Department of Agriculture official who spent most of her life advocating for the rights of farmers. She gave a speech where a clip was taken out of context by conservative blogger Andrew Breitbart, making it seem as if she was saying that she hated helping white farmers. But the opposite was true. She was hung out to dry by the United States Department of Agriculture, the NAACP, and more. She wrote The Courage to Hope, How I Stood Up to the Politics of Fear, to talk about that incident and about growing up in the segregated South and fighting for farmers' rights.
You came from an incredibly brave and powerful family of black farmers who owned land.
Right. That's right. My grandmother's family. Actually, I don't know exactly when they arrived in Baker County, but I did find them in the 1870 census, so that I know they were there shortly after the Civil War. I don't know whether they were there as slaves or not.
What happened to your dad? Every time I read it, it's chilling.
Yes.
I mean, just anybody who loses somebody that close. You were only 17.
Right.
The story, I think, is important to hear, too, because it feeds directly into the lies that were told about you later.
Mm-hmm. It's almost 48 years ago, next month, in fact. It was a time when things were going well on the farm. My father had fought the battle to become the first black person to borrow money to build a home. They had made some self-help housing loans, and some of those houses didn't quite come up right. But he was actually successful with borrowing the money to have a builder build his home. And he really, really, really wanted a brick home. But they told him a black person couldn't borrow money to build a brick home. He had to either choose cinder block or wood. On the morning of March 14th, we were on our way to church. Now, all of us could drive. I started driving the car up and down the road. I mean, not the road, up and down the yard when I was like 4 or 5. I was driving a tractor at an early age, you know, so we could all drive. But I was driving us to church that Sunday morning when we met this man who shot my father the next day. We met him on the road, and so we stopped, and my father leaned over to talk to him, and he said he wanted to get the cow. My father said, if you come back tomorrow, I'll get some others to meet us at the pasture, because they had had trouble. What happened was in 63, this man had five or six cows to get out of his pasture, and they ended up wandering over into our pasture. They rounded all but one of them up. They had trouble getting him, and he just left him there. So he was coming back, he said, to get this cow. So my father told him, we meet around at the pasture at 9 the next morning, and he would get help to get him. But when they all met there, they were the man who worked on the farm with my father, the white guy brought a black man with him, and my mother's brother. My father, they all met him there to get the cow, but instead of his one cow, he was claiming 5 or 6 other cows in the pasture. And they argued about it, and they, according to the others, my father told him, we don't need to keep arguing, finally, he said that, and said, we'll just go to court. And my father started walking away to his truck and turned around to say something, and the man shot him. He lingered for 10 days before he finally died. The grand jury refused to indict him. They said it was self-defense. We sued him, and of course you still had an all-white jury in Baker County, so nothing ever happened. You probably heard during the 2010 event that the Justice Department came in and gathered the records. And then they sent us a letter in 2011 saying that it was a criminal investigation, and since the man died in 76, they didn't feel they could do any more with it and just dropped it. A reporter called me just last week, and I said, you know, they could have said, it for us, for the children, could have said, at least in this case, justice was not served. It would have helped.
Helping small farmers, that's what your struggle has been about. That's how
yes.
You translated your struggle about human freedom into that work.
But let me tell you something. Growing up on that farm and picking cotton and doing all that work, I vowed that agriculture was the last thing I ever wanted to have anything to do with. But you can never say what you'll never do.
As you wrote that line in the book
yes.
as well. Here we need to bring up one piece that I think is an important piece, and here is the Pickford case,
mm-hmm.
Timothy Pickford.
Yeah.
Because all that, what that case meant and how that was resolved just as you were about to take this new job, and how it also has reshaped your life now
yeah.
and allowed you to do the work you're doing now.
Yes. Well, see, we were losing so much farmland and so many black farmers. We knew that the things we were doing at that point, we're not getting to the root of the problem. And we had talked about a lawsuit. And when I say we, I'm talking about not only those of us in the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, but members of other groups. And some of them were majority white groups that we were networking with at the time. And I can remember we had had a meeting in Atlanta, and this was about 1990. And we made the decision that it was necessary to file a lawsuit. So we had a nonprofit law firm out of Minnesota involved and one out of North Carolina, and they decided they would be the attorneys for this case. So they said they did a FOIA request to get the information on complaints that black farmers had filed. And they sent a note back saying they didn't have any. Well, we had to file a lawsuit just to get them. And they finally sent 55 boxes. And that's, yes, we did 6 test cases. And this was prior to Pickford. And then what happened, and you have these lawyers who can be crooked. One lawyer out of Texas, after most of that work had been done, actually went to those farmers, and they didn't know. He got them to sign a retainer. So he had those cases. He was later disbarred because of some of the things he did in that case, in those cases. But it laid the groundwork then for Pickford. And one of the things that had to be dealt with is the statute of limitation. So Congress had to actually deal with the statute of limitation for the Pickford case to go forward. And they used the years 1981 to 1996 because when Reagan became president, he abolished the Office of Civil Rights at USDA. So if farmers complained, the complaint didn't go anywhere. So with Pickford, any farmer who experienced, and you had farmers who had experienced discrimination long before 1981, but with Pickford, any farmer who experienced discrimination between 1981 and 1996 could actually file a claim in the Pickford case. So then the question of going to court or settling, and there were lots of issues around that, and some black farm groups formed. In fact, his name will come to me out of Virginia, John Boyd. His organization formed during that time when we were trying to decide whether to settle or actually go to court. And we knew that a lot of farmers didn't keep the detailed records that were necessary to go to court. So in the end, we agreed to settle, and that meant that you had two classes of farmers, Class A and Class B. If you filed as a Class A farmer, and this was the sad thing that the lawyers actually described this to us in such a way, you didn't have any farmer trying to get rich. If they could just get their debt written off so that they could get a new start, they would have been satisfied with that. So that's how the lawyers couched it to us. If you don't have to have much proof of the discrimination, you don't need to use every incident of discrimination to file an A claim. And supposedly they would get $50,000. They would get $12,500 as tax on the 50, and they would get their debt written off. With Class B, if you had a lot more documentation of the discrimination, then you could file a B claim and have your one day in court, and that award, there was no limit on the award. Well, most farmers, out of a little over 22,000 of those farmers in what we call Pickford 1, most of them filed a Class A claim. Like I said, they were not trying to get rich, but to have the opportunity to get a new start was what they were looking for. Well, the government wasn't totally honest with us. In the end, the $12,500 that was supposed to be taxes on the 50, that was taxable too and got a lot of farmers in trouble. The other thing is they were only willing to write off debt for the type of discrimination you use. And remember I told you, they said you don't need to use every type, every incident of discrimination, just use one. So if you use one that you experienced while you were trying to get an operating loan and you didn't have an outstanding operating loan, then you didn't get any debt written off. So that was another trick that farmers experienced. And then with the B claim, I was so busy. I was, it was a time you only had 6 months. You didn't see ads on the radio telling farmers that you could file a claim like you do with most lawsuits. So the burden of trying to get that word out there was on all of us who were activists in the farm movement. So we were busy trying to get that word out to farmers. And it was while I was driving from Alabama one night when I had been in Alabama helping farmers during the day that the light bulb went off with me. My goodness, we were farming in 1981, we can file a claim. The we was New Communities Incorporated during the Civil Rights Movement, as we were helping people to exercise their rights. Many of them would get kicked off the land owned by white people. And that's a terrible feeling when you've encouraged someone to be active in the movement, and then you don't have a place for them to take their family. So we came up with this idea of trying to build a community. And in 1968, we sent seven people, including one was my husband, to Israel to study the kibbutz. And the Mor Shavim model was the better model, because with the kibbutz, kids or raise communally, and that wouldn't work with us. So we created a land trust, the first community-based land trust. And if you Google New Communities, you'll see some of that history in the U.S. And we got our hands on 6,000 acres of land. I won't go into all that happened, but I'll just tell you that due to discrimination at USDA, we lost that land in 1985. You know, so I've so busy helping others, almost forgot we could file a claim. And so I didn't have a cell phone or anything and couldn't wait to get home to tell my husband we could file a claim. We actually had 3 months left in the process, because you have 6 months to file. And we filed our claim prior to the end of the 6 months for New Communities. Took 10 years, 10 whole years. Just a few things that happened during that. We were, the wife of the chief adjudicator was our hearing officer. Should have been a conflict there.
You think so?
Yes. 2 years after our hearing, and she denied us, by the way. We knew we had won that case when we left the courtroom that day, but she ruled against us, which meant we had to appeal. And the judge had put a process in place where he appointed a monitor to hear these cases that would be appealed. Well, the monitor had to recuse herself because we were friends. She was out of Minnesota. So they had to find someone else to handle New Communities' appeal. In the meantime, I was reading the paper about 2 years after that hearing, and the name, the lawyer for the Justice Department, the name had just escaped me, but they were saying this woman had been arrested in California. She wasn't a lawyer. She was the person who was working for the Justice Department as a lawyer in our case. But they sent us a letter saying, yeah, that she actually worked on four cases while she was there, but it won't have any bearing on your case. They found someone to handle New Communities' appeal, and it took that individual 4 years, but he produced a document documenting all of the mistakes that had been made by the original hearing officer. So in 2006, we filed a claim in 1999. So in 2006, the chief adjudicator wrote a letter to us saying that what they found had merit, but it was an extensive case, and it would take some time to review it. And we didn't hear a thing from October 2006 until our lawyer called us on the night of July 8th to say we had won. And she was so excited. You know, it had been 10 years. So she said, Shirley, we won. Did you hear? And I said, no. She said, you want to guess how much? And I said, Rose, is it at least $1 million? She said, no, it's 12. You know, so.
That was Shirley Sherrod, author of The Courage to Hope, How I Stood Up to the Politics of Fear. Now we hear from Mother Jones food and ag blogger, Tom Philpott, about two recent studies, one that looks at sugar and the other, the Mediterranean diet. Could the amount of sugar a nation consumes per capita drive instances of diabetes and more? But let's start with what you discovered around diabetes.
These researchers did a big study looking at diabetes rates in 175 countries, and they wanted to see if there were any, if they could detect a trend between sweetener consumption, you know, how much sugar, and this is high fructose corn syrup is, refined cane sugar, you know, table sugar are the two main ones. There's also beet sugar. It's sort of like the industrial food system's added sugar. So they had data on 175 countries and looked at diabetes rates, type 2 diabetes, and compared it to sugar consumption or sweetener consumption. And they tracked it against a whole variety of variables, obesity, age, activity, you know, sort of physical activity, whatever data they could, whatever sort of measures they could come up with. And they found that the only one of those factors that was directly tied to a country's diabetes rate was its sweetener consumption. And so what that means, according to them, is that what is driving this global rise in diabetes rate is the global rise in sweetener consumption. And so it's kind of a smoking gun situation for sweeteners that suggests that, you know, that amazing amount of added sweeteners we have in our diet, you know, in everything from ketchup to salad dressing to sodas to...
To your alleged healthy Yoplait yogurt.
Yogurt is now as hearted up with sugar as a Coca-Cola is.
Right.
You know, all these different ways that we're getting it, it is driving type 2 diabetes. If you have type 2 diabetes, you're way more at risk for having a heart attack. You're way more at risk for having a stroke. And I think the most shocking recent research is suggesting that the root of Alzheimer's disease is insulin resistance. But it can literally destroy your brain.
Now, talk about this Mediterranean diet piece again, because as I jokingly opened the show with it, you wrote about that as well in this column. Because it's not something that's new. I mean, there have been so many studies about this Mediterranean diet over the last 30 years or so, 40 years, that show its health benefits, but it's back on the front page again.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Mediterranean diet, I think, is that I think it really ends up just being a marker for the sort of pre-industrial diet that we were just discussing. It's the diet that it's, I think, you know, it's the diet that evolved in the Mediterranean era before the era of sort of food industrialization. And it holds fast in the Mediterranean in pockets. You know, it's actually in the Mediterranean region, it's falling apart. People are moving towards more industrial foods. Classic Mediterranean diet. So it's this diet that evolved through kind of poverty. And it's... you know, sort of eating low in the food chain, not a lot of meat, a good amount of fish because you're right there on the coast in the Mediterranean, and a lot of shellfish and things like that. Lots of vegetables, lots of weeds. Basically arugula, which is sort of the fancy salad green that we appreciate now, evolved as a weed in the Mediterranean, and it still grows wild there, and people still harvest it and eat it as a salad. And so, all this is to say that the Mediterranean diet is just kind of a marker for this this is what the Mediterranean diet is. It's this marker for this pre-industrial diet, and it's a marker for a diet before meat became this sort of cheap and ubiquitous thing, and also before sugar and sweetener became this cheap and ubiquitous thing that's in everything. And it's basically based on cooking your own very simple food, a little piece of fish on a grill with some lentils and some vegetables is the classic Mediterranean diet. In study after study, you basically name it, in study after study, this diet has proven to do all kinds of great things. Eating real food, even at the age of, between 60 and 80, can save you from a heart attack.
Thank you to Tom Philpott, food and ag blogger for Mother Jones Magazine. And now we wrap up our show with a segment where we invite Soundbites contributors to give us seasonal and sustainable recipes. Today we're joined by Liam Flynn, owner of Liam Flynn's Ale House at 22 West North Avenue in Baltimore. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, he shares a traditional Irish recipe with all of us.
This is cold cannon, which is really a traditional basic recipe that can be used in the spring or is used around Halloween. It's a all-around dish. Irish cuisine tends to be seasonal, but this is one dish that you'll see through the whole thing. And since it's St. Patrick's Day, which is La Ella Parig, so this is a recipe my mother and I used to make. And it's pretty basic. You're going to need about 3 pounds of potatoes, a couple of sticks of butter, a quarter cup of milk or cream, and black pepper, a head of cabbage, finely shredded. Some people will add in ham or bacon or boiling bacon at the end, but really the meat, we never used to do it with the meat. And then scallions and or green onions and parsley at the end. Steam your potatoes, not boil them, because they have more nutrients. You want to scrub them with the skin on. Once you've steamed the potatoes, which takes about 30 minutes, you want to remove the skins. Then you finally chop the cabbage. Some people prefer kale. Go through and you make a mash of the potatoes using butter and cream. Once you've mashed the potatoes and seasoned to taste, then you add in the cabbage, and you want to add in some chopped green onions, finely chopped, and that gives it that nice onion bite. Make a bowl in the middle of the mashed potato dish, like a cauldron, and you put in butter, and you can put on parsley. At the end, some people will throw in a little ham at the end. A lot of this, you can switch off to make it more of a vegan recipe. Substitute the dairy with olive oil. You can use a veggie butter. But really, the Irish are known for dairy and have some of the best butter and cream in the world. So you're sort of bringing down the dish if you don't use dairy. But if you're lactose intolerant or vegan or whatever, you can still make the dish and it'll taste great. Now, a lot of these ingredients can be found in local farmers market, like the Waverly Farmers Market. So if you want to get local cream, there's South Mountain Creamery. There's kale or cabbage you can get from Big City Farms. For a beverage pairing, I would suggest there's a lot of local beers. One I like that is similar to an Irish red, but it's an excellent amber. It's the Public Works Red Scent Amber from the new Peabody Heights Brewery in Waverly. There's also, you have Union Brewery. I would suggest, if you can get it, they have a pregame, which is an English mild brown. I know English on St. Patrick's Day, but actually the beers are very similar. So, and any good stout, Oliver's has a good range. They have an Irish red. Union has put out a fairly good oatmeal stout that sells very well here. So I would suggest that for pairing.
That was Liam Flynn of Liam Flynn's Ale House, and that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Tom Philpott, Suru Jaraman, Liam Flynn, and Shirley Sherrod. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.